Granite. There is no way to love a man. Not well, or rather, not correctly. Maggie knows this, and loves him anyway. A vast stupidity of love that a part of her views with a painful sort of irony. Of course you love him, you fool, you idiot. What an utterly moronic thing to go and do. Her friends are nurses, midwives, physical therapists. They discuss the issue with clinical focus over Chenin Blanc and Twiglets. Men, they say, are not built to withstand the same internal pressures. You can see it in their hips, the way they breathe after running. A lack in anatomical endurance. From a purely physical perspective, it is hard to love a man without breaking him apart. Her friends have husbands, speak on good authority. She is late to the party, almost 30 years old. It's a design flaw, they tell her, refilling her glass, a novice before the collective. Not their fault, exactly. Isn't to say that you can't love them, just that you have to be careful doing it. They show her photographs on their phones, smiling men, ordinary in earth tones and morning suits, the men they have married and branded and kept for themselves. To her eyes, there is nothing obviously wrong with any of them. They all wear logo t-shirts, like to pose next to barbecues, all seem partially blinded by the sun. Her friends, however, tap their screens to zoom in on throats and the corners of eyelids, reminding her that to love a man is to watch him buckle. She comes away drunk and weaving slightly, catching her heels in the down escalator on the tube. Her friends text her later to ensure she got home okay, reminding her to be careful how she goes. We're glad you're happy, Maggie. Messages like little stones thrown into water, insincere and easily dismissed. He is tall in her tiny kitchen, autumnal in his work clothes. He works in horticulture, designing gardens for historic properties, and his body is a dense, outdoorsy object. Crisp cold, tang of stone and mineral. The bonfire sweetness when she kisses his cheek. She thinks about him all day at work, answering calls with his voice caught up in her intonation. Picking compulsively at her cuticles, doodling his name in the claims forms, and ripping them up to ensure that no one sees. Once, she forgets, fills in an entire sheet with his name, address, and telephone number, and posts it as internal mail, so that 2 days later he starts getting calls about his non-existent insurance claim, and she has to speak to customer services. Clerical error, she tells them, and imagines them seeing through to the inner mess of her, though in reality she is only asked not to make everyone's job harder by being slipshod with her own. Coming home, she picks up supermarket wine and stupid canapes, prawn mousse on scallop shells, Jerusalem artichoke crisps. He usually cooks dinner, but she likes to contribute something, to pass him something on a plate and watch him eat it. The journey home has been transformed, a surprisingly luxurious thing. On the tube, her carrier bags bump against her ankles, the crush, the tinny overspill of other people's music. Yet all of this is now somehow part of a larger picture. Changing lines, an assault of elbows, doors closing on the edge of her sleeve, and yet anticipation like something worn about the shoulders, impervious to all discomfort. In her flat, the charm of his bare feet on her floorboards, stooping to kiss her, holding his hands away from her sides.
Don't touch me, Mag. I'm covered in garlic.
I wasn't going to touch you. Why would I touch you? I don't know where you've been. She kisses him again like that, holding her hands away in mimicry, half notion of a game for later. He quirks an eyebrow at her, and she pulls away, pours two glasses of wine. He cooks because he is better at it. He understands which flavours go together. How to time things so that nothing burns. She clowns to cover her comparative uselessness, serves her pre-bought canapés with exaggerated flourish, blinis plated in concentric circles, dates split lengthways and piled with Shropshire blue. "Imagine if I could actually cook," she says, offering up a deviled egg between pursed fingers. "What a catch I'd be."
"Triple threat," he agrees. "Singing, dancing, cordon bleu."
"Probably just as well I have a flaw," she nods, watching him edge a saucepan of something fragrant off the heat, the dark breadth of him beneath the strip light. "Makes me more human, don't you think?" Over dinner, he tells her a story about an argument he had with a client, the owner of some 20 acres of parkland, who wanted the centrepiece on a restored sculpture fountain done in an inferior granite rather than marble to keep expenses down. Later, he scrubs his hands to rid them of the garlic and pulls her to him with his fingers still wet, hard at the tips, and oddly gritty. They had met at a birthday party for someone her friends had been hoping she would marry. A stupid sort of day, insincere with sunshine. She had sat on the patio steps and watched people she didn't know eating mozzarella and beef tomatoes, bacon-wrapped chicken, sugar-dusted donuts and commis pears. Thelonious Monk playing on someone's speakers, round midnight at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Her main impression of the person she had been dragged there to meet was that he was very loud and welcoming and she couldn't wait for him to go away. He had shown her his collection of branded shot glasses from his trip around America, and she had nodded and finished her drink too quickly, spilling seethe of tonic water over her wrists. In the past, her friends had accused her of being picky, rolled their eyes at her inability to overlook a bad shirt, asked gently if she thought she was so very perfect herself. "No sense wishing," they would say, weary when she found a man dull or difficult. "Maybe you're better off without." She would agree with them, of course. Frank feminist, happy with her job and her hobbies, easy in her single skin. Privately, however, she knew herself better. Knew herself for what she was. A great failure at solitude. Sluicing through her 20s, illuminated only by the glow of terrestrial television, finding much to her dismay, at the age of 29, that she longed to amuse and to be longed for. A faint life, eating apricots and growing bony and forgetting how to talk to people. Loneliness like a taste on the skin. He had turned up late to the party, too tall in the patio doorway, bumping his head on the lintel. Gentle touch of his hand. A relief great enough to change the very music on the speakers. Thelonious Monk cycling through to Werewolves of London by Warren Zevon. Whoever had made the playlist clearly hadn't given much thought to the importance of Segway. Her flat came ready furnished, and the wallpaper is the colour of veal, overcooked and slightly sickly. The same colour which has seeped into the carpet and the curtains, the counterpane on the bed. In the mornings, his right thigh makes a clicking sound, like the resettling of a bone in its socket. His groan, a painful satisfaction. Lifting his arms above his head to snap his shoulders into place. As a boy, so he tells her, his mother would insist that cracking his knuckles would lead to arthritis. Reading aloud to him from Mary Poppins, his mother would place particular emphasis on the character of Mrs. Corrie, the woman with the barley sugar fingers who snapped them off for other people to eat. "There was a lesson in that for me somewhere," he reflects, "though it mostly just made me bite my nails." Clouded with morning, his body is a curious jigsaw. She takes his fingers and kisses them, mimes a bite to the tip of his thumb. She usually showers before sleeping, and overnight her hair dries into ridiculous contours, pale blonde and fluffy with static from her percale sheets. She jokes about her hair having a life of its own, and he tugs gently at it, pulls his hand away in a mime of alarm. "Something bit me." "You think you're so funny." Mornings have been the hardest things to adapt to. Company after 3 decades of waking up alone. She has always considered herself the kind of person seen to best effect at 4 p.m, once the day has burnt away and softened up her difficulties. Having someone with her from the outset gives her no rehearsal space, no time to sink down into some more pliable version of the creature she is to begin with. "I like quiet in the mornings," she had told him once, pressing a hand to his mouth before he was properly conscious, so that he had woken up blinking rapidly and thinking he was being attacked. Once he had understood her, he had done as she asked, dressing with his tongue between his teeth, and she had found herself talking to him anyway. Holding up 2 shirts and asking for an opinion, catching his eye in the mirror and feeling guilty as he mimed incapability, a stitched-up voodoo mouth. "You can talk," she had said at last. "I'm sorry." Pulling invisible threads from his lips, dragging out his voice like something caught in a net. He leaves earlier than she does, pulling on his wax jacket and his backpack, too tall for her without her shoes. On the way out, she hears him calling good morning to her elderly neighbour, Mrs. Loomis, who occupies the basement flat and has taken to loitering in the corridor to tell him he has no business messing with lonely girls.
"Don't think I don't see you, my lad. You think you can move about beneath my notice, but I see what you do. Watch your step. Mind your feet."
"I will, Mrs. Loomis. I've got my walking boots on." In the 15 minutes after he leaves, the relief of space falls flush against the greater relief of missing him. Maggie tames her hair with pins, lipsticks her mouth. Leaving for work, she finds Mrs. Loomis still in the hallway, waiting to fix her with a wounded look and call her Margaret, which is not her given name.
"It's Maggie, Mrs. Loomis. Just Maggie. You know, we don't need to be so formal with each other. We've been neighbours for 2 years.
Mrs. Loomis stares at her, wraithish figure in the corridor, as though the dust from all the unswept corners has been thrown by some disturbance into brief corporality. She is a sore-boned woman, grimly hyaline, wigged to cover the bald head that Maggie has glimpsed occasionally, pale through the basement window bars.
"Your visitor slams doors,"
her voice like a path picked through glass.
"All night, the noise, slamming and footsteps, stops me sleeping."
"I'm sorry if he does,"
Maggie replies, unaccountably depressed by the droop of Mrs. Loomis's wrists, egg-skin sliver of white between her nose and upper lip. In recent weeks, Mrs. Loomis's eyes have started losing colour at their centres. Maggie imagines the morning crusts at the corners of her eyelids as flecks of iris that have leaked out in the night.
"I have to go to work now, but I'll talk to him about it."
"You needn't do that,"
Mrs. Loomis speaks quickly, the scrabbling fright of someone caught in a lie.
"Just don't have him here anymore. Then he won't have doors to slam."
"I don't think..."
"Better for everyone,"
Mrs. Loomis barrels on, face set with some unpleasant meaning.
"In the long run, better for him to not be here."
Maggie looks at her, at the rubbed-off corners of her lonely body, and registers a certain pricking horror, a hot, unsettled recognition. All the way to work, she feels it, needles in the hollows of her feet. Morning sky, gasp of purple, like the dark part at the back of a throat. Day like a swallow, promise of snow. A chilly sliver of floor. She picks barefoot across the kitchen to gather coffee, croissants warmed in the oven. She piles a tray with milk and butter knives, honey and apricot jam. Thinks about it for a second, and then forces open the frosted kitchen window, pulling a spray of winter cyclamen from the planter outside. This she arranges in a water glass beside the coffee press, standing anxiously back to assess the effect. On impulse, she pulls the flowers from the glass and tucks them behind her ear. Thinks better of it and returns them to the glass again.
"You have a wet ear,"
he says when she brings in the tray. His voice is bad today, gravelled with cold. And as she clambers in beside him, he turns away from her to sneeze. She has a funny impulse to kiss him then, to take his germs or whatever is wrong with him into herself on a long inhalation. A disgusting sort of perversion, love. Her bedroom is warm, rat king of tights on the dressing table chair. His shoes are upside down and drying on the radiator. At work the previous day, he had turned his ankle on a patch of slate paving. The skin around the bone is already mottled, dark spread like a spilling, blue and grey. "Better stay off your feet for the weekend," she had said, waggling her eyebrows at him to make him laugh. He had stolen arnica from her bathroom cupboard to bring out the bruising, smell of antiseptic on his palms. After coffee and croissants, he presses her down into the mattress. In her tenderized meat-coloured room, he holds her wrists together, bites her neck. Stone weight of him, a reassuring breadth. Later on, she goes back to the kitchen to wash up. Looking out into the shared garden, she sees Mrs. Loomis making a shuffling tour of the lawn in the first of the snow. A strange sight, spectral, like death walking in the morning, looking for its lost cat. The key, she has been taught by the books she reads, is to love a man slightly less than he loves you. That way, you remain in some sense unreachable, an inch above the floor. It is the shape of his mouth that makes this impossible, the crest of freckles up his back. He sleeps as if murdered, as if set in concrete, flat out and immobile. On one of their first nights together, he had set 7 alarms to go off at 3-minute intervals, and in the morning had slept through every one. She had lain there confused, dead man in her bed. Had realised that there could be no way of loving sensibly if every morning started with the relief of finding him still alive. Her friends call him the gorgeous man. Say it to his face sometimes, the way one might address a dog. And how is the gorgeous man today? In meeting him, they seem collectively to have forgotten that they ever accused her of being fussy. Worth the wait, they tell her smugly, as if the advice had been theirs. He's a paragon. Now, for God's sake, don't screw it up. The snow settles, city pressed in clay. You can feel the confusion, a tightening of formerly unsolid things, ice on car windows, difficult breath. His ankle has continued to trouble him, an irritation that lasts into the week. On the Wednesday, he rolls up his trouser leg, and she sees that the bruise has blurred down into something stranger, greyer, an unexpected goriness that makes her bite her lip. "Is it painful?" she asks, watching him hop about her kitchen, though he only shakes his head, chops onions, reaches for the salt. "Not particularly. It's mostly just annoying." He tells her that when he was 13, he grew 9 inches in the space of a summer and was barely able to walk. "My mother called it the bad summer," he says, gesturing to his hip. "The tops of my legs kept popping out of their sockets because everything was growing too fast. She tells these stories about me falling downstairs because I couldn't get a measure of myself. These great piles of limbs she'd find everywhere. Like my body was coming apart or like something was trying to get out. Sounds brutal, but honestly, I barely remember it now." She loves stories like this. Loves to describe her childhood back to him, her own swift descent of stairs, finding points of congruence in a never-ceasing fascination, the smells and morning newspapers and little superstitions that bridged their early lives, every similarity more meaningful than she knows it ought to be. In truth, of course, there is little correlation. He grew up further north than she did. A big house, an anthology of cousins, a string of dynastic family dogs. Her childhood was a smaller thing. Ugly duckling, her teeth birdcaged with braces. barely 5 feet tall by the age of 15, she had spent her school days being left off netball teams, styling her hair to cover her face. Her mother, a narrow-lipped, resourceful woman, had told her at her university graduation that no one was going to marry her with a miserable face like that. She likes to tell him things like this, and watch his forehead contract as he tries and fails to picture it. In this way, she becomes aware of the curious history of the world, the wide gulfs of experience that can exist between lovers. After dinner, they watch television, and she takes his feet into her lap. In the dark, his skin has a blue tinge, as though it has been through the wash with a new pair of jeans. She rubs circles in his ankle with her thumb, frowning at the texture. The skin is dry beneath her fingers, a sensation like wax, like the breaking down of a doll. It is easy enough, of course, to forget that she loves him. On the days between frenzies, when he leaves muddy footprints on the kitchen lino, when he whistles through his teeth. No one, she is sure, is capable of loving all the time, without interruptions or reprieves. Occasionally, there will simply be days when he smells wrong, when she thinks she spots something different inside him, and then she will push him away when he tries to kiss her, wipe her mouth with the back of her hand. Sometimes, she fantasizes that he has died in some cinematic disaster, run down by a motorcycle, a clot on his lungs. In these dreams, she goes to his funeral in a Spanish mantilla, and afterwards moves far away to a place where it rains. The fantasy is detailed, though changeable. She gets a job in a cafe or a cinema, learns to roast a chicken. Sometimes she has his name tattooed on her ankle, and sometimes she pierces her ears. Eventually she moves in with some handsome local man with no passions and no interests, who kisses well and doesn't need to be loved. They live together, in the broad, forgetful blue of this town, sharing nothing of themselves, perfectly happy. The culmination of these fantasies always scares her, and she finds herself calling him up at his house, just to hear him, bleary and irritated at some throwaway hour of the night.
"I just called to say I love you," she will say,
and he will tell her to stop quoting 80s pop music at him and to call him again at 9. Her friends are impatient with her inconsistencies, tell her she is looking for excuses.
"You have what you wanted. Why pick holes in it?"
She tries to tell them that that isn't what she means to do, sour with salted crisps and mulish at being, as she sees it, willfully misunderstood. She leans forward over her knees and says again that she is happy with him. She isn't disputing that fact, but her friends only have to move the wine away from her and remind her of what she was like before he came along.
"Maybe you were alone too long to find it easy now, Maggie. But that shouldn't be an excuse."
These lectures leave her feeling self-righteous, unfairly chastised. Coming home, sticky-lipped from the wine and the argument, she will grumble and thrash her way through a solitary evening, watching television alone and ignoring her friends' messages, heating dinner in the microwave. She will canonize her former loneliness with a tang of self-pity, pretend to revel in the re-established silence, the remote control and sofa to herself. Before him, she had often wondered whether solitude was a skill one could lose, like schoolgirl Latin, or whether it was simply a talent one acquired, bike-like, never afterwards forgotten. Now, of course, she knows her limits better. By the end of a single evening alone, she is usually sated. Calls him up to ask what he's up to, and whether he wouldn't rather come and be with her. Mrs. Loomis is on the basement stairs without her wig, skunk-like in a balding housecoat. Maggie tries to get past without comment, but Mrs. Loomis never emerges unless she has something to say.
Your visitor was at it again. All night, the slamming and the crashing. Rock slides through my ceiling. Not a wink of sleep.
He really wasn't, Mrs. Loomis.
Maggie is tired, carrying Chinese food that is burning through her shirt.
We went to bed at 9:30. He doesn't get up in the night.
Mrs. Loomis shakes her head, and Maggie finds herself guiltily transfixed by the egg-cup curve of her skull. She thinks of the box of wigs with which her mother had once encouraged her to play dress-up, imagines herself fitting polyester hair to her neighbour's head, the bobbed red wig, the sleek Elvira.
"Better to send him away with all that banging," Mrs. Loomis continues. "Doesn't suit it here. Better to send him off."
Maggie is distracted, eager to get upstairs.
"If you're hearing anything, Mrs. Loomis, I can promise you it isn't him. Maybe we have a ghost."
"Or maybe you're making it up," she doesn't quite say, only hiking the bag of Chinese food higher up her chest. Mrs. Loomis shakes her head.
"No ghosts, dear, just you and me and him."
She escapes without good manners, gesturing to her food in half apology and staggering backwards up the steps. She finds him in her kitchen, awkwardly collecting up pieces of a bowl he has apparently just smashed.
"And I told Mrs. Loomis you weren't the one making noise," she sighs, putting down her Chinese food and crouching to help him, swatting his apologies away.
The bowl is glazed blue pottery, a tourist purchase from a week in Stoke, and he pieces it back together with a sweet precision, promising to find some glue. She pulls his hands away, already laughing, though the shock of his fingers is enough to blunt her smile. He is cold, even for a chilly evening, and she quickly sets him to unpacking the hot plastic tubs of beef chow mein. He has been off work the past couple of days at her insistence. His ankle is worse and frustrating him, and his cold seems no better. At night, his breathing is difficult, a crumbling thing, like a flaking off of paint. He tells her, shrugging, that he had pneumonia as a boy and is simply more susceptible to cold and flu, though his shrug makes such a blur of cracking noises that she is almost too distracted to respond.
"You shouldn't work outside," she tells him later, eating sesame noodles on the sofa and drawing distracted circles on his leg.
Propped on the coffee table, his feet are white and bloodless, a peculiar beating of his pulse high up in his knees.
"Not in the snow, anyway. Not in weather like this."
"Got to earn my filthy lucre," he replies, nudging her hand deliberately off his leg. "Keep you in a manner to which you're accustomed."
It is a joke, though a weary one, and he yawns right through its middle in a way which messes up the tone. Rolling his shoulder, another fluster of splintering sounds, he slides further down the sofa. A banging sound starts up, noise like pipes thumping up through the floorboards, and it takes Maggie several moments to realise that Mrs. Loomis is beating at her ceiling with something like a broomstick. A rhythmic imperative. Get out. The first time they had slept together had also been the first time. She had never told anybody this. She is, after all, practically 30. She had bled, of course, and passed it off as her period.
"Talk about bad timing."
A nervous snort of a laugh. He had ignored this, kissed her chin, and eased her over onto her side. And she had loved him then about as much as she ever would come to later. Loved him for the ache of his kindness and the things he chose not to see. The pain had been worse than expected, though not in the way she had imagined it might hurt. She had always pictured men battering away at her, a great internal shearing, a falling all to bits. In truth, of course, it was all very much as her most honest friends had assured her, ineffably more boring and more enjoyable, the pain sharper and more localised,
egg crack against the rim of a bowl. Afterwards, he had not smoked a cigarette, or talked, or tried to hold her. Only fallen asleep for a curious half hour, and then woken again, asking whether he had been snoring. Pale man in her meat-coloured bedroom. Long blue eyes, and his smell like grass and eiderdown, and something stranger, damp, down a wall. Looking at him then, she had thought about all the men who might have preceded him. The men she had allowed to take her out to movies and sit down dinners, but forestalled before letting them get into her flat. Always a reason, of course, a stupid comment or a quick flash of violence, a seam of cruelty in some region of their bodies, a grabbing hand, a dark and fleshy underside. Enough, whatever the reason, to make her wish to bar their way any further, to invent excuses and take the train back home alone.
"There's always something with you," her friends had said to her. "Always something with any man you meet. It's like you don't want a man at all. You want an object, something you can put away."
In truth, she had often wondered whether the problem was actually her, whether she brought out the monsters in them. By logic alone, after all, they couldn't all be as dreadful as they seemed when she got to know them. Or else why would anyone marry them, want to have them near? Prolonged contact, she had reasoned, when slick with Chardonnay, deep in self-pitying vein. That must be it. Too long with me and they all turn, become worse. That first night with him, she had watched for the change, a shifting in aspect, a recarving of the bones in his face. She has watched for it every night since, that sudden monstering, but so far has found nothing. Perhaps, she hopes, whatever power she has is waning. Perhaps she can control it with a man she loves. Look at this. She's brushing her hair in the dressing table mirror. Wide yawn of morning. The snow is packed tight outside. Soft pulse like the struggle of bound wings. Still looking in the mirror, she sees him holding up his hands. The skin around his fingernails is mottled dark, as though he has soaked his hands in vinegar. As she watches, he rubs one wrist against the other. A strange solidity of movement, rattle as of something thrown. In the foxed glass, there seems little delineation between his fingers. They bunch together stiffly, unyielding and brittle as handfuls of cutlery. "What is that?" she asks. "Chilblains?"
"I don't know," he replies. "Must be. This weather."
"You have to keep warm," she says, biting her lip as he catches her eye in the mirror. "You never wear socks."
"Not on my hands, no."
"Not on your feet, either. It's not funny. This is why you're always catching colds." He nods, crossing the floor to press a placating kiss to her head, shooting her reflection a smile which she does not return. Her hair has turned to straw in the cold weather, and she yanks hard at a snarl, sharp split of pain. In the kitchen, she pieces the blue bowl back together with superglue and watches Mrs. Loomis from the window. Her neighbour is making her customary tour of the garden, though the snow is now knee-deep in some places and unpleasantly gritty besides. It has been a strange week, inconstant with its light and with its timings. Long afternoons stem from mornings passed in the tilt of an egg timer, whilst an hour of every night seems to last its own century. Whole epochs dragged out in stubborn wakefulness, and his painful breathing on the left side of the bed. Thick with flu, he has stayed the week more or less involuntarily. She has piled him with duvets and is keeping him, what she fears might appear, a sort of prisoner, though he has stopped protesting since he lost the feeling in his feet.
"Very misery,"
he had joked weakly, in response to her first assault on the bedroom with soup and ginger ale, though he has since grown sleepier and less prone to comment. In response, she had thought to say something light-hearted about being his number one fan, though it had occurred to her just in time that such a comment might be taken as more threatening than it was meant. The snow has packed the city so densely that nothing can be moved. There is no work to go to, no trains, no buses, and streetlights go down intermittently at night. Standing by the kitchen window, Maggie holds the bowl in cupped hands to speed the glue's drying. In the garden, Mrs. Loomis has paused in her rotation and is inspecting a seemingly unremarkable patch of snow. She is wigless again today, although Maggie is oddly relieved to note that she has at least chosen to wind a scarf around her head. The woolen tassels at each end hang down like a mime of hair, little coils of green angora fringing the back of her neck. Watching at the window, Maggie finds herself thinking of a story her mother used to tell her, about an old lady who had lived alone in their street for 70 years before finally being found desiccated in the pantry, having fallen and apparently been pickled by the fumes from an open drum of vinegar she kept there for fixing preserves. For her part, Maggie had always found it a little unfair that her mother should encourage her to be so fiercely independent whilst also making a horror story out of being alone. Later, once she has shelved the mended bowl, Maggie goes back to the bedroom and slips under the covers, curling into his side in the way she has become used to, fitting her feet to the backs of his knees. His hands, when she touches them, are heavy and strange, and he mumbles to her about barley sugar. Drifting in and out of sleep, she thinks of hibernation, of things that turn hard and crystallize as a way of surviving the cold. The first time they met, he had handed her a beer with his thumb pressed to the top of the bottle to prevent it fizzing over her dress.
"So, what's wrong with you?" she had asked him. "Why are you single?"
He had laughed, cracking reflexively at his knuckles, and asked what was wrong with her.
"Make a list," she had shrugged. "Bitch, Gorgon, I'm difficult."
"Says who?"
"Me, mostly. My friends say I put people off."
Her friends had warned her against throwing herself too rashly at a man she knew nothing about.
"Don't put your eggs in one basket," they had counselled. "You know how easily disappointed you can be."
Of course, since these were the same friends who had variously advised her never to love a man, but still to find a man, to settle for a man, to wait for perfection, to move on and change the subject, she had ultimately ignored them all, swanned her neck, and fallen for him anyway. The first time he had stayed over, Mrs. Loomis had emerged from the basement in the tight blue morning when Maggie was coming down to fetch the newspapers.
"New man,"
Mrs. Loomis had said, and Maggie had been surprised by her, lopsided in her white blonde wig.
"Something wrong?"
"What? No, nothing's wrong. Long time no see, Mrs. Loomis. Thought maybe you'd moved out and left me."
Mrs. Loomis had said nothing to this, only pulling a tragic expression that Maggie had found somehow grotesque, and looking up towards the stairs.
"Difficult,"
she had said, apparently to herself.
"Trying to keep a man. Always safer not to look directly at them."
She wakes, as usual, to one of his alarms. He, as usual, does not. The morning is still dark beyond the curtains. Snow dark. A crust of rime about its edges. Freeze bite before a thaw.
"How are you feeling?"
Moving slowly, still bleary from a cold and shifting sleep, she presses her legs against his, makes to warm her feet against his ankles. A strange sensation. She blinks. The bedclothes are cool around him, heavy object wrapped in cloth. Leaning up on one elbow, she touches his shoulder, tries to brush his hair from his eyes, and meets resistance. Clink, like china. The light is bad, too chilly for any clarity, though from what little she can see, it seems that something is wrong with his face. She says his name, touches his wrist. A feeling like fingers pressed to a wall. He is hard stone, though not quite marble. Something granular, granite, or porous limestone. Dark gravity in the left side of her bed. She tries to hold him, but the stone is coarse, untreated. He starts to come apart in her hands.